inner hall of life.
Welcome to the Inner Ho Uprising, a podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black polyamorous feminist ho living in New York City.
And me, Rodeca, sometimes Rebecca, a fat black pansexual who lives.
I was going to say, what is her name? What is her name? And I was like, oh, let me
People
not interject.
People are seriously like not knowing what my name is.
It's Rod.
It's Rod. I'm Rebecca.
So Rodeca. What happens when I just want to make
for
jokes
fun.
All the time?
Sorry. And I am a fat black pansexual whose life is a series of coincidences that somehow landed her here.
Oh, you had to say that, huh?
And
you
I'm
had
here.
To get your jokes
yes,
off.
Yes, guys.
I respect it. This is season 4 of the Inner Hall Uprising podcast, and we are mixing it up a bit. Now that Rob is gone, every month we'll be hitting you with 2 group episodes and 2 interview episodes. This episode is an interview episode, so later on you're going to hear the wonderful Raquel Willis talk about the unsung black trans heroines in American history. It was a dope ass conversation. Please continue, but for the next 10 minutes, listen to our bullshit. Listen to these little segments. And then when we have these group episodes, it'll be me, Akua, Ro Dix, as I like to call her, in one room getting each other horny.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
you think
be
there's
the
a punchline, but there is none.
No,
it's
yeah,
just
that's
exactly
actually
that.
That's actually what it is.
Stay tuned.
Those episodes will be us talking about current events, our raunchy ass sex lives, and reading your listener letters. And then our interview episodes will basically be our fuck it segment, our little topic of the day with people who are cool and important and insightful on said topic. Doing a whole episode. So yeah, interview episode. Cool. If you're a new listener, we have some segments here for you.
They are Bay of the Week,
where we talk about people who we find attractive.
Ho of the Week,
where we talk about people who pay us money.
I was like, what is this? Is this your sex? Is this one of
damn, bitch.
Remember,
that's why nobody wants to fuck me.
This just reminded me, yeah, exactly. This reminded me of like when I was a kid, and I was thinking about this the other day, and there's a reason why.
This is a weird segue.
Listen, it reminds me of when, like, you know how you phoned into those sex operator lines?
I've
like,
literally never done that in my entire 26 years on this
well,
earth.
Anyway,
but okay.
Everyone's done
and
that.
And my 1 year on Mars. I don't know what you're talking
on
about.
Mars. Yeah. But anyway, I used to, like, run up to the payphone with my friends and, like,
what kind of childhood? Why were you watching Hey Arnold like everyone else?
I've always been this way. I was born this way.
I see.
But yes, as soon as you started talking, I was like, is this a sex operator line? But I had to give that back.
I'm glad I provided that nostalgia
yeah.
from when you were like 11.
Some weird
calling
nostalgia.
In.
Sometimes, like,
payphone. I've never used one of those. People
I feel
urinate
like those
on things those
things are normal for me until I hear other people laugh or give me the worst. It's either laughter or the worst thing is just like this look of just like, were you? Did you have a damn?
I used to catfish a 45-year-old man on
oh,
Gaia
God.
Or whatever.
I mean, yeah, Gaia online.
What's but the next segment? Because we have gone so far off topic.
Self-care tip of the week.
Where we give you guys some advice on how to take care of yourself. Like, don't go on Gaia.
Yeah, there you go.
Don't use payphones because people urinate on those. What
well,
the fuck?
Well, they didn't before. Like, before, people actually used them to call people on the street.
And urinate on them at the same
time. Okay,
no,
but you didn't have to think about
that
those
That was
things.
Access, yeah.
Yeah. Fuck it.
Which is our topic of the day. And today we are discussing Black Transgender Women's History for Women's History Month. Enjoy. What are our hashtags?
If you would like to follow along with the conversation had in this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag InnerHoUprising so we can see it and the hashtag PodIn so other people can see it.
If you want to pay us to speak at your school or conference about sex positivity, black feminism, or the fact that you should stay away from corny ass niggas, and other types of topics we discuss on this here show, we would love to do so. So please to book us, send us a line to IHUpodcast@gmail.com.
We've gotten your inquiries.
Yeah.
We will get to them in time.
Thanks. Yeah, exactly. I hit these bitches up a year ago. What the fuck? I thought they wanted a speaking gig.
I said in time. I did not say how long.
Yeah.
But on to our first segment. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about our bay of the week.
Yeah. I have 2 bays of the week, and they've both been to space.
What?
Yeah. I have an honor and a privilege at work to be doing something. I guess I won't say what it is. I'm producing a podcast at work.
Okay.
Yeah, I might cut that out, but whatever. So I've had the honor and privilege of, like, talking to astronauts.
Which...
Yeah.
Can we talk about
yeah,
that?
I just never thought that was something that I would ever even do. I used to really like space when I was younger and be like, yeah, I got to go there, you know?
I really wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then I watched the documentary and I said, oh shit, niggas die out there. And, like, that dream literally died in that documentary.
I used to have Mae Jemison hanging up on my fridge.
Wow.
Yeah, not on my wall, on my fridge, because I have a relationship with food that's very important, more than bed. But yeah, so I looked up to her that much or whatever. My dad is just kind of a history buff, so I guess we're bonding over that or whatever. But then I believe it was the Columbia that crashed, like when I was like 12 years old or something like that. And we didn't know any of these people, but we cared so much that then that was the picture hanging on our fridge.
Wow.
Like those like 8 astronauts who like died.
That shit was real,
and
though.
Yeah, that fucking freaked me out. I'm not sure if that's when I was like, fuck space, or just like learning about racism. I pivoted from science to like social science. Although, like, you can be both, but yeah. There was a point in my life where I was just like, ooh, this is a hella tangent. But what's his name? Jill Scott Heron.
Okay.
Has a song called Whitey on the Moon, or a poem called Whitey on the Moon. And basically, like, the thesis of it is, like, y'all niggas is really going to space, but, like, we are in here and the project's dying. So what the fuck do I care about white people on the moon? And that was definitely my point of view for, like, a good 5 years. And now I work at a science and tech publication. And I'm like, oh.
Where did I go wrong?
Who is Elongated Musk? I don't know what any of you are talking about. It's mad imposter syndrome at that place. Because I'm like,
yikes.
I don't know how I got this job. The cover letter was a lie. No. I mean, I know stuff, but, like, not as much as I would have been curious about if I wasn't so inundated with daily oppression all of the time. So,
well,
yeah.
I mean, you still got something good out of it.
Yeah.
I got to talk to
yeah. astronauts. Yeah, so this week I got the chance to speak on the phone with Mae Jemison for a little bit, and that was, like, really fucking cool. And obviously I've loved her since she was hanging on my fridge back when I was a little girl. And she's, like, starring in this new documentary series on National Geographic called One Strange Rock. And I just
with Will Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the first episode last night. It was cool.
Will Smith
does everything
great.
He
turned out to be fucking great. I mean,
yeah,
he was great before.
But they were like, welcome to Miami. Like, that's, we weren't sure
you
what
know,
was going. And
we
then
didn't
also
know
Wild
which side
Wild
of the
West. Exactly. But like, Fresh Prince was great. iRobot was great.
Yeah.
So, but no, he's definitely legendary status and not like what he could have become.
Exactly. I respect him.
Yeah.
I have a respect for him.
Yeah.
Which
I
is
like
not,
the way he treats his kids.
Yeah. I just think that they're
weird as fuck, but he encourages their curiosity, and I dig that. And I think
yeah,
more
I
black parents
like
should
Willow.
Do that.
Willow's kind of like, you know, into nature and like rocks and stuff, and I respect that.
I love minerals.
You know, she's just like drawing stuff and you know, feminist.
They're cool kids.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think Jaden's a bit of an asshole. I feel like he thinks he's smarter than he actually is, and that's kind of annoying.
Wasn't there like a thread like on his tweets and how weird they are?
They are really weird tweets.
They're like, if a man lands in the forest, is he still?
Exactly.
Is Earth still around? Some shit like that.
If a man lands in the forest, is he still? Question mark.
That's it. Actually, that was perfect. And right there.
Yeah, so shout out to Mae Jemison. And then also featured in that documentary is this lady named Peggy Whitson, I didn't either, but she, until I like started working on this project for work, she spent, oh fuck, let me just type it in really quick.
I just Google it.
How much time has she been in space? Like 600 days or something like that.
665 days, 22 hours and 22 minutes.
Isn't that fucking cool?
That's crazy.
She's 58 fucking years old.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And, like, she just, like, her last run was, like, 2 years ago or something like that. Between the last 2 years, because it's, like, documented in this,
It's documented in
this documentary. She's cool as fuck. I'm just like, damn, you're a badass. Like, I just didn't even think or know about any of these things.
It's weird because, like, her world, her perspective is just so different.
Yeah, but shout out to these people. Yeah, astronauts are fucking cool, especially women astronauts. Out of the 545, something like that, people who have been in space, only 59 have been women.
Wow.
That's a fucked up number. That's 11%.
45 people have been in space and only 50 or so have been women.
Yeah, 59. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's fucked up. Yeah. And then we need to like study female bodies in space, because what happens when you have your period in space?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm just reciting shit that I've learned for this project, like, but that's what I did on the Sex Robots episode. So another interesting thing was like Sally Ride during her first run in space. They were like, it was like 8 days or something like that. They were like, or a month or something, just a short period of time. NASA was like, how many tampons should we give you? NASA was like, how many tampons should we give you? And then the guy was like, is 100 a good number? And she was like, no, 100 is not a good number. Like, that's excessive. Like, what do you, like, have you ever talked to a person with a vagina ever in your life?
100?
Yeah.
Imagine.
That's when you just start playing games with tampons in space because you're like, why do I have this many tampons?
Could you imagine if we needed 100, like,
each
time?
That's a fucked up flow, bro.
That's crazy.
Oh, and you guys God. Still want to pay women 70 cents on the dollar? And you
think it's a luxury item.
We're buying 100 tampons a month? What the fuck?
My babe of the week.
Yeah.
Because, guys, I love learning new things and spreading it amongst you guys.
So I can debate with people about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. But this one's not a debate. This one is true facts. One of the few women in Philly to own black women. One of the first. The first. Mm-hmm. Black woman yeah. in Philly to own her own business.
Oh shit.
She is the OG of the church hat.
Oh, that's fucking cool.
What a church hat is yeah. if you don't.
Unless you're like white or something.
Unless you're okay.
In which case, turn this podcast off and pay me my reparations.
So you sure you made it to the right place if you don't know what a church hat if you're white. No, honestly, I wasn't talking about the church hat. I'm talking about white. We do have white listeners though.
We have mad white listeners. But do you pay us our reparations if not turn this off? Apple podcast is free, but we're
not. It's not pay a whole time yet.
I'm so sorry.
That's what
I'm like, what is this accent I'm doing? I don't know.
It's always that accent for like a southerner or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Pay me my reparations.
May Reeves.
Yeah.
She was, I think the word for a hat maker is a milliner. It's a milliner. It's a person who makes women's hats specifically.
Oh, wow.
Millinery.
That's a name.
It is.
Cool.
There's a word for everything.
True.
They're not always good words, but they exist.
You cunt.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And she's basically the pioneer of making those hats.
That's
when
cool.
When they were lit at one point in time.
Lit in a certain population.
But they weren't they're being mass produced now. She was making them by hand and she bought a business. She got like $500 and like made a name for herself.
That's
so
a
much
bad
so
bitch.
That we all know the Smithsonian Museum, African American Museum in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
There is an exhibit for all of her hats.
That's so cool.
And she made it. She lived to 104.
Damn.
Because of those hats.
I don't quite see the medical correlation, but you know,
she didn't stop making hats
science.
Until she was 85.
Damn. And then what, she just chilled for 20 goddamn
yeah,
years?
Yeah, man. Like, I don't even think she thought she was going to make it that far. So it was kind of like, all right, fuck it. I'm just going to do whatever.
I'll just die now. And yeah. She lived for like 20 more years.
Yeah, and she
That's
got an
so
exhibit
cool.
in the Smithsonian. So those hats are an important part of our history, guys.
Yeah. Our next segment is Hoe of the Week. That's where we shout out you guys, the homies, the listeners. And we want to give three quick special shout outs to... First of all, Sarah. Of Sarah Shailene Photography, who just offered to do a photo shoot for the Inner Hoe Uprising. But
and
she's really
everything came out incredible. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know how sometimes people offer their services and it's like, we'll take whatever we get. We got like $1 million service.
Yeah.
And we appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. Pay me my Sorry, Sarah.
Reparations can come in any form.
But yeah, a free photo shoot. Yeah,
we're just joking. also, and Flash Magazine, mm-hmm. we did a spread with them recently.
Yeah,
that was great. I think that was the first time we ever did a photo shoot together, aside from like that one, which was just like a quick
that
photo.
That was Wise taking
and it
a picture.
Just turned out perfectly.
Yeah, he took a great picture.
It was.
He should probably go into
the best picture anyone has ever taken of us. Because
I know of me.
No, yeah.
I've never looked better.
This is when I just first cut my hair. So I just cut my hair.
Yeah.
And I was wearing a hat.
Yeah.
Which was an incredible feat in and of itself because I have a huge head.
So good hats. Yes. Inner Hoe Uprising hats.
Yeah. But yeah, Flash Magazine also took photos of us. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty fun. It was cold.
Yeah.
So thank you for working with us on that one.
Yeah.
And there was this asshole pizza shop guy who didn't want to.
That was the worst pizza I've ever had in my entire
life. Honestly, it was like cafeteria pizza, but worse.
Exactly.
It was.
I didn't think pizza could get that bag in New York, but special shout out to Shantae who like coordinated the whole damn thing. She's dope and awesome. We also did an interview with her. Now, self-care tip of the week.
Let's do it.
Do you have one?
I have one.
You do.
But I like yours.
It's the fact that I put a question mark because I don't know if that's actually taking care of yourself. I don't know if
coffee is actually not bad for you.
I think
if
it's
you
just
have
like
one a day.
Yeah, it's not like good or bad. It's just like a substance.
But tell us about coffee naps.
Yeah, that's another reason why I was unsure if this is healthy or not, because you know being sleep deprived is obviously not healthy. But something that I do when I'm mad tired, which is actually all of the time, is like drink a cup of coffee and then take a 15-minute nap and then wake up because I feel better.
Talk to me about that.
I mean, the coffee obviously energizes you because that's what coffee does, bro, when it's caffeinated and shit. And then it doesn't like kick in until like 30 minutes or whatever. So you have the time to.
Wow.
Yeah, you have the time to like take a nap and shit like that. Now on to Payaho. If you guys would like to help sustain the Inner Hall Uprising podcast monetarily, you can do so by going to innerhalluprising.com and clicking the tab Payaho. You can also go to paypal.me/innerhall, which does the exact same thing. It takes you to our PayPal. You can buy merchandise by going to innerhalluprising.com and clicking the merchandise tab if you like a cool hoodie or a t-shirt. You can use the sponsor codes used in not this but previous and future episodes, because when you support our sponsors, you do support us. You can also now support a hoe on a monthly basis by subscribing to us on Patreon.
Woo!
And you can receive perks while you're doing it. This is an easy way to throw some dollars monthly towards the show, because studios, transportation, and events ain't cheap. If you're able and you'd be so kind to visit our Patreon page, you can do so by going to patreon.com/innerhalluprising and donate $2, which will give you access to private IHU gatherings like the party we're throwing next month. That's Woo! A lie. We're not throwing a party next month. But one day we will throw a party and you should be there. So get on it. You'll also get our undying love and affection. Those people who missed out on Rob's going away party know exactly what I'm talking about. And for the price of $5 a month, you can get all that as well as some exclusive behind the scenes video content, perfect for people who want to see the uncut scenes from episodes. What did we do today that was uncut?
There's some sexy time going on in here, and you wouldn't know unless you go on the Patreon.
We did anal. One day somebody's going to subscribe and be like, they're not doing anything.
They're going to be so tight.
They're going to be like, wow, you just on Instagram. Ugly.
Yep. Yeah, mostly. Oh, man, I remember one time
Sam,
I walked in.
You don't have eyebrows.
I walked in, and I was like, oh, shit, this is the worst day for me to be recording. So you get to see me in my prime.
Live and in the flesh. You can donate less or more, so anything from $1 a month to $1 zillion a month, Elon Muskrat, is appreciated. This is just a consistent way to pay ho, pretty much spending what you would for give me something that's $5.
A sandwich.
A durag.
Oh, okay. Oh shit.
I don't know.
A deli store sandwich.
Yeah, except for when you're in Manhattan and they're like, this is $8.
What the fuck is up
it's
with
really
that?
It's really $8, yeah. Always.
Because the bread is artisanal or some shit. I don't know.
That bread is not artisanal.
And it doesn't even take good.
Pretty much spending less of what you would for an artisanal fucked up sandwich, but to help your favorite hoes instead. We're going to get into the actual show now. Ready for our interview with Raquel Willis. This segment is called
Fuck It.
And it is our topic of the day.
That's a party on the weekend. That's a party on the weekend. She loved a party on the weekend. She loved a party on the weekend.
Raquel Willis is a Black queer transgender activist, writer, and media maven dedicated to inspiring and elevating marginalized individuals, particularly transgender women of color. She's a national organizer for Transgender Law Center, the largest organization in the U.S., advocating on behalf of transgender and gender nonconforming people. Today, for a very special week of programming in honor of Women's History Month, she is here to talk a bit about the unsung Black trans heroines in American history. Welcome, Raquel.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here via phone.
Thank you.
So if we can start off, can you tell us a little bit about your work and what it is that you do?
Yeah, so I always have to start off by saying that I am from Augusta, Georgia.
Represent.
Oh, Augusta.
Yeah, so I'm like, I guess I'm like a country girl.
Okay.
Somewhat. It's not so rural. But I like to claim it. And so I grew up in Georgia and really found myself in college at the University of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of my foundation for social justice and women's studies and all that cute liberal progressive stuff.
Yeah.
It was there that I met other queer folks, found my identity, and started getting involved with the local queer community, essentially. And so I was the executive director of our LGBTQ student group, and that kind of wasn't a formative experience because I realized that I really wanted to use my talents and my interest in journalism and storytelling to really make the world essentially a better place for trans women of color and Black trans women.
Mm-hmm.
And so after working at a small newspaper in Monroe, Georgia, and then working at another place for an online publication, I decided that I wanted to be more invested in my social justice work. And so I took a job here at the Transgender Law Center. And so from there, you know, things have just been amazing. I'm a national organizer, and I travel across the country with an amazing team of other organizers here. And we basically give people the skills and resources to advocate for whatever campaigns that they're working on, whether it's anti-trans legislation. We know that there are disgusting bathroom bills popping up all the time, right? There are a lot of ways in which politicians, usually conservative ones, are trying to curtail our rights. Mm-hmm. And so folks are always organizing to resist that kind of BS. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited to be on and excited to share more about Black trans women, because I think that we have a long history that is constantly being uncovered every day.
That was an awesome answer, because you answered the second question that I had for you, which is why, and you can elaborate more, but why even studying Black trans women's history is important for everyone.
Well, definitely. You know, one of the things that is so aggravating to me is when people, and it's usually cishet people, so yeah, I'm going to call y'all out for a second. Only the finest and purest trash. But they often say things like, oh, this trans stuff is so new. You know, there's this idea that we just popped up on Earth yesterday. And the truth is that trans and gender nonconforming people have existed in every culture throughout the history of humanity, mm-hmm. right? And so that is especially true for Black folks. There were trans and GNC folks, maybe not with the same terms, using the same terms for themselves, but there were definitely people who were transcending gender norms in ancient Africa. Mm-hmm. There are people today in Africa who are doing those things.
Yeah.
and especially in the history of the United States. So, you know, if you think about slavery, right, one thing that has been mind-blowing to me over the years is learning that, oh, there were trans and GNC folks who were enslaved, and how that history is still, again, being uncovered.
Mm-hmm. The reason why we asked to have you on the show is because we stumbled upon this Twitter thread that you did for Black History Month back in 2017. And you kind of framed the whole thread by stating that most of Black trans folks, historical Black trans folks in the United States, circa, let's say, the 1800s, were only known because transphobia was so widespread at that moment in time. Can you expand a little bit more on what those circumstances were and why that sadly allowed for us to recognize those people now looking back into history?
Right. Well, you know, I think even with that, right, the transphobia, of course, still goes on today.
Definitely.
And so we still have moments in the media, right? If we look at the media and see how an amazing woman, a Black trans woman, Janet Mock, was treated by the host of The Breakfast Club.
Yeah,
what,
complete trash.
Just like half a year ago, right? Mm-hmm. If we see how other moments throughout our history, even if you think about someone like Caitlyn Jenner, right, the sensationalism that goes into trans stories when they become mainstream or when cisgender people start to consume them, right? And so mm-hmm. that's nothing new. That's something that has very much been historical. And so my point with that was that the instances that we know of Black trans folks and Black GNC folks from back in the day really were instances where they weren't actually being depicted respectfully.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the people that I talked about in that thread, right, were people who had run-ins with law enforcement, right, in the criminal justice system. And there are plenty of trans activists today, right, who have had a history of being in the criminal justice system. And so the ways that we think about Blackness as being other in the United States, but also opening us up to also being seen as as criminals. That is a similar thing that happens for people who are gender nonconforming or who are trans. And so when you layer those on top of each other and you're Black and trans, you have an even deeper web of issues with how our government treats you. And so that's why it's been so important in my trajectory in the social justice work that I do to get to a point where I could be unapologetic about the fact that I'm prioritizing the interventions happening in the Black community mm-hmm. for Black trans people. Mm-hmm. Because it's so needed, it's so dire.
So now we're going to kind of get into these awesome unsung heroines that you so eloquently documented in the Twitter thread that we referred to earlier, but kind of just like really delving into who these people were, what they did, their impact on American history, their impact on trans history, and all that good stuff. I'm very excited.
And since it is Women's History Month, we are going to focus on, I mean, everyone, they're all heroes. And you did mention a lot of people. We are going to focus more on the transgender women that you mentioned. We could start with Mary Jones. Take us back to the 1800s.
Yeah. And so I just want to be clear that I am not a historian at all.
That's right.
And so I am a person who loves the internet. I know my way around the internet. Yeah. And I think being a Black trans woman, it was important for me to find some of these stories so that I could see myself in history for once, mm-hmm. because yeah. I hadn't seen us pre-Stonewall, really, yeah. until I started doing yeah. some digging into archives online.
And
go ahead.
If I could just briefly interject, and like some of the posts that you did have, like you linked sources for everything, which was awesome. And then when you kind of like delve into these sources, they're hella transphobic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yes, you know, so I read up on each of these people mm-hmm. In this thread. I try not to post random things, you know, that I have actually in indulge myself in. Mm-hmm. But before I start, I do want to give a shout out to some amazing books that also have some deeper yeah. history, right? So more recently, there was a book by C. Riley Snorton. Mm-hmm. And so they're an amazing Black trans person who is a historian and who has done great work, awesome. Black trans man. And so their book is called Black on Both Sides. Oh. And so it's really dope. And they go into a lot of detail on really the artistic and visual representation of Black gender nonconformity, particularly in the early 20th century. Mm. So with Mary Jones, based on the source, this happened in the summer of 1836, right? And so when I posted this, folks made a comment of, well, why was she someone to look up to? She was a prostitute, right? And so I do want to be clear that, first of all, I'm pro-sex workers, mm-hmm. right? So I believe that we need to respect and honor sex workers mm-hmm. Way more than they actually are and actually protect them. Mm-hmm. I also want us to be clear about the context that a lot of trans women, particularly Black trans women, have lived in the past and currently live in, right, in which we live in a society that says that we shouldn't exist, and so that opens us up to discrimination, meaning that our access to jobs isn't going to be the same as it would be for our cis counterparts. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about sex work as really one of the only options that many people have, let's keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. So there's that. So Mary Jones, she was a sex worker. And so the story says that she, you know, would meet up with men, wouldn't necessarily tell them, you know, that she was trans. And she had all of these ways in which she made it so that she could pass, right? So that she could survive. Mm-hmm. And The story is that she basically was arrested for stealing the wallets of one of her clients. And so it became this huge kind of scandal in the media. And she was put on trial. And in the trial, she actually, actually stood her ground and said that she was a woman and that actually up until this point, she had really been accepted in communities of color. And so if you think about the ways in which she told her story of being accepted in communities of color, and now she's on trial and being sensationalized by this white, basically white supremacist criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. I think that that is so key. And also a big moment for us to think about how white supremacy has really damaged some of our thoughts on gender throughout the Black experience, right? And so thinking about things like the Moynihan Report and how that has damaged thoughts around Black motherhood and thoughts around the Black family structure, right?
Can you explain a bit about what that is?
I'm getting so deep on this.
That's okay. We'd love to get in the weeds on this show.
Yeah, so the Moynihan Report, it was chronicled in this book actually called The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. And so it was written by this white man named Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a sociologist, and he actually worked under President Lyndon B. Johnson. So This is old school stuff. This was published in 1965, and essentially the Moynihan Report basically took stabs at the Black family structure and blamed a matriarchal structure for the devastation that happens in Black communities, right? So essentially blaming Black women and Black mothers for why Black people in general weren't succeeding in the way that their white counterparts are, right? And so we know that that is very fraught with so many issues, and so many issues around misogyny and trying to say that women should have a certain role in our families and in our love lives, right? Of one of submission. And that when women aren't submissive and Black women, and because Black women weren't submissive in the way that white women are to their husbands and their lovers, that was a problem. Well, that has really tainted, right? Portrayals of Black women since then in media. But it also has really colored how we think about the Black family, and we continue to demonize Black mothers. We continue to demonize single Black mothers.
Yeah.
And so when you think about historically when the war on drugs kind of ramped up, right, in the late 70s, early 80s, and we were seeing black men mostly being taken out of homes, put in cages, put in the prison industrial complex, we continue to see a further demonization of Black women, right? And so it fed into that feedback loop of misogynoir.
Which Hotep still use to this day.
Right.
They're just reciting the Moynihan Report, which is like...
Right, and so they don't actually even, a lot of them don't actually even know that these thoughts that they have on the Black family returning to some traditional structure are actually BS, that we've always had complex thoughts on how families are run and what works for us. And so it's really sad when people basically recite the Moynihan Report and don't know that their ideology is coming from a white man.
Yeah, which is why we arm people with this information. Because exactly. I didn't know that, so now I can yell at a Hotep.
Yeah. Could be like, you're speaking the white man's words.
This is the Moynihan Report.
Right. That's one of the earliest instances that I've seen of a Black trans woman being documented, right? And and obviously she probably didn't use trans. She probably just said she was a woman, because those distinctions between being trans and cis weren't there, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to skip maybe like 30 years forward to someone we mentioned during the Black History Month series that we did when we were covering the OGs of the Me Too movement.
The first one.
And we considered Frances Thompson one of the OGs of the Me Too movement for speaking out about
the Memphis riots.
Yeah, and the sexual assaults that happened to her during the Memphis riots.
She was one of the five women who were raped during the riots.
And yes, she's and like, testified.
Exactly.
As a Black Southern trans woman, I especially feel tethered to her just because I had never ever really thought about trans people being enslaved. You know, like I assumed obviously that there were Black enslaved folks, but I didn't have any stories to like back reference up, and to hear about her and hear how defiant of white supremacy she was, so much so that she testified in 1866, like y'all were saying, when a committee was investigating the riot, and she basically, you know, shared her story about being raped, and so she is considered to many the first trans woman to testify before a congressional committee in the United States. And so how big that is, right? For her to even feel that that was an option for her with all of the different identities that she was carrying. And it's so very telling of this long history of harassment and sexual violence that Black trans women have been facing, right? And it still goes on today. In many of the cases of Black trans women being murdered, a lot of times they are domestic violence situations. A lot of times they are intimate partner violence situations. And so I honestly see us us having conversations, and I'm saying us as the Black community, having conversations on gender and healthy relationships and complex sexuality as a key for us to kind of solve some of the issues happening when Black trans women are targeted.
Let's move on to Lucy Hicks Anderson. I was reading about her and I was so like, I was kind of upset just because of the fact that like, she just wanted to be married to someone that she loved. And they did everything along the way to just like, make it seem like he was being coerced or kind of just like against his will. And she ended up basically tried for it.
The fight for marriage equality, right, is something seen as more recent, something seen as led by basically cis white gay people, cis white gay men, cis white lesbians. But with Lucy Hicks Anderson, who was born in 1886, she actually is one of the earliest documented fighters for marriage equality. And so she was a Southern girl, got to make that shout out. And she actually started presenting as a girl at a young age, right? And so her story is so interesting because for a long time, trans people didn't really get to experiment or find themselves until much later in life. And it's really only been the last maybe decade, but not even really, where trans people are coming out at younger and younger ages. But to think of her asserting her identity at such a young age back in the 1800s is amazing.
Yeah.
She lived in New Mexico, and that's where she married her husband, Clarence Hicks. So that's where the Hicks comes from. And so she was married to him, and she actually operated a brothel, right? And so there's that narrative of sex work, right, being something that was a chance at livelihood for Black trans women. She actually divorced the Hicks guy, right? And so to think that she was essentially married twice.
Yeah.
You know, like, she was just living her life. Like, you weren't going to tell her nothing.
Nope.
But then she married another guy named Reuben Anderson in 1944. And so when they were signing this marriage license, it was there that they really kind of came up with this perjury charge against her. because there were no saying legal that, you know, obligations. She was lying about her identity. Mm. And so one of the quotes that has been documented of her saying is, "I defy any doctor in the world to prove that I am not a woman. I have lived, dressed, acted just what I am, a woman." And so even that defiance continuing.
Mm-hmm.
So her story is one that is amazing. It's also interesting, too, because there are other sources that say that, you know, she actually was seen as like a socialite, and she would throw these huge parties, and actually was in very good relationship with local government officials and I think also like the police chief and all of those folks. But of course, when she was outed, that shifted a lot of things.
Her narrative just seems like a great film that I want to watch.
I'm surprised it hasn't already been made a film.
Well,
but,
why
you know,
do you think?
Yeah, exactly.
But one day, for the filmmakers out there listening, this would be so awesome.
Yeah, right? It just seems like an adventure.
It's a love story. She's a freaking socialite. Like, I just like it.
You just gave me an idea.
Please. If you want to direct this film, we will back you in any way that we can.
Also, Carlette Brown should have been made. That's the next person.
Mm-hmm.
She should have her own movie because, like, Jet Magazine, and she was willing to renounce, like, her whole American citizenship just to be what she is, a woman, you know? And it's interesting because to juxtapose what Lucy, who always knew when she was a kid, like, that she was a woman, Carlette kind of lived her life as a man but was a female impersonator later on, and then found out that they were intersex. So she ended up saying that the doctor said that she should go toward typically male. Well, she was like, no, I want to go towards being a woman because that's what I am.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, all of these stories are so interesting, and knowing that, like you said, people assume that it's just a modern issue, but it's something that has been fought for
so
long.
Of course.
Obviously.
Yeah.
So Carlette Brown was a Black woman who wanted to go through a similar procedure. And like you said, she was a former Navy vet who did female impersonation and was considered a shake dancer in nightclubs. And I want to be clear, too, about the context, right? So in many places at that time, it was still illegal to wear clothing of what was considered the opposite sex or opposite gender at that time.
Oh, wow.
Right? And so if we think about the Stonewall riots, a lot of that popped off partially because people were, you know, same gender loving or queer, but also because people were basically expressing their gender in ways that were seen as atypical.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, people who were assigned male at birth, wearing feminine clothing, right? There were some laws that said you couldn't wear more than like two articles of clothing or something like that, that weren't aligned with the gender you were assigned at birth, you know. And so thinking about how trans, again, has continued to be criminalized all the way up until now, where we see this guy in the White House going after the trans community at every turn. So anyway, back to Carlette Brown. So again, her story is interesting because she actually had her experience somewhat chronicled through Jet Magazine. So she kind of came out and said that she was interested in having the surgery. And then, you know, there would be periodic updates about her experience. And then also, again, thinking that about Jet as this historical Black magazine covering this. When it's hard to even get any kind of queer trans Black person on BET right now, right? So just saying. but yeah, and so you know, we don't know if she actually ever was able to realize her dreams of having the surgery that she wanted. She actually ran into trouble and was arrested because of one of those anti-cross-dressing laws at the time. Mm-hmm. And so they ordered her not to leave, and then she had to pay $1,200 in back taxes.
Which is a lot.
Yeah.
At that time, was a lot of money. A lot. Right? So if you think about somebody trying to save up for this major surgery, that probably was a huge setback for her.
Continuing on, or kind of moving backwards, in your thread, you had mentioned a documented drag party that was raided back in 1888. In this article that you talked about, you mentioned that one of the historians who was analyzing this historic raid said that he believes that if some of the people who were doing drag back then were alive today, they may very well have identified as transgender. And I kind of wanted to contextualize that with these recent comments that RuPaul made regarding his show, RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm just going to read his quotes and kind of let you contextualize that. But basically, during an interview.
Okay, you read and then I'll read.
Yes.
Exactly. So during an interview, RuPaul said, drag loses its sense of danger and its sense of irony once it's not men doing it, because at its core, it's a social statement and a big F you to male dominated culture. So for men to do it, it's really punk rock because it's a real rejection of masculinity. And then when the interviewer, who had done their research more than Paul had done his research, said, well, you did have a transgender woman on your show. Her name was Peppermint. RuPaul responded, it's an interesting area. Peppermint didn't get breast implants until after she left our show. She was identifying as a woman, but hadn't really transitioned. So you can...
The biggest eye roll is going on over
here. Yeah. So, like, what are the implications of his statements, considering the fact that transgender women probably started drag in the first place?
The biggest implication is that he definitely showed his whole entire ass. And showed his capacity as a cis black man to be misogynistic, right?
Yeah.
And so this is also a longstanding conversation that I think a lot of women and gay men have been having, right, around the lines between misogyny and homophobia, right? And so these kind of interesting patterns of relationship that all of us have, even though we're all marginalized in sometimes similar ways. And so it was very disappointing to hear him say that, but it wasn't surprising because he said essentially transphobic things throughout the course of, at least the last few years.
Yeah.
One thing that sticks out from a few years ago was him saying, oh, it's fine for him to say tranny because, he is, I think at the time he was saying he's like essentially seen as like a transvestite or something like that. And I'm like, I get what you're trying to say, but there needs to be some contextualization for this.
Yeah.
Because even though there are trans women who appreciate the word tranny and use it for themselves, many of them are very clear that they don't necessarily want other people to call them that, right? Yeah. And so if we think about reclaimed terms, but it's also we're in a specific time now where many of us understand a little bit better some of us a little bit, only a little bit better, the distinctions between being a trans woman and being a cis man who is a drag performer, right? So those are different, right? But trans women also are drag performers and have always been drag performers. Mm-hmm. If we think about the history, like you were saying, like this article from the 1800s of this drag party where there were people who probably fit in line with all the various queer identities we know exist today, commingling and existing, right? But then if we think about the ways in which drag became more organized through ball culture, right, which is an important part of Black history that we often don't talk enough about, we think about the houses that emerged. I had a conversation with the amazing, iconic Miss Major, right? Who was this major figure in the early LGBTQ rights movement, a Black trans woman, who is still around today, by the way. So another note of like how this stuff didn't happen that long ago. But she was talking about how she was friends with this woman named Crystal LaBeija, this Black trans woman, who was the mother of the House of LaBeija, which is documented in this historic film called, I think it's simply called The Queen, basically about ball culture and in pageant culture, right? So, and that was filmed, I want to say...
1967.
Was it 1967?
Well, that's when the film was released.
Yeah. Right. And so, yeah, so if you think about that short kind of film, and then you think about Paris is Burning, that was released in 1989, maybe, and how that featured some descendants of Crystal LaBeija, and they were talking about how Crystal was the founder of the house. Pepper LaBeija is the one who is who's depicted as the mother at that time. There's this long history of ball culture and it as a safe haven for Black gay men and Black trans women and Black queer folks in general, right? And so we've always existed beside each other. So it's disgusting to hear RuPaul say these things and then reduce trans women to our bodies and to what we may or may not do to our bodies. So it ignores that there are plenty of cis men who perform drag who have had work done, you know, because this may be their lifeblood. This may be this is their work. This is their craft. And there are plenty of people who have gone on Drag Race who were cis male identified, who had all types of their faces done, and it was never a problem, right? And so we have to look at that double standard, and we also have to look at what I think is this tension and insecurity that happens from a lot of cis men performers. In my experience, because I actually used to be a performer in college, where there's this assumption that, oh, well, if you transition or you're trans, that means that people are gonna like your female illusion better. And yeah, that's possible. That's not necessarily always true. But we don't need to cut people down for being their truest and fullest selves.
Yeah.
Right? We just need to contend with it. And just because you are, you know, what the kids call fishy and all of that and passable as maybe a cis woman, that doesn't necessarily mean you're a good performer or the best performer.
Yeah.
Right? And so the beauty myth in drag culture is something that also needs to be discussed.
Which is why we're going to have an episode about it.
Yeah, exactly.
At some point.
And I was going to say that's actually a good tie-in into back to the timeline that we were doing. Sir Lady Java, who was one of the pioneers in challenging LA's anti-cross-dressing law. She was actually a performer, which is funny because RuPaul wants to say it's only for... men, but she was a performer and a damn good one. And she was basically challenged because of the anti-cross-dressing law at Red Fox, I believe, his club. And she used to perform there and she had to stop because of that. So she picketed it outside.
Wow.
Yeah. But I just wanted to talk about that because she is someone who would be passing. She was very notable for the fact that she, I think she had a 34-inch bust, 24-inch waist. What's a 24-inch waist? never heard of it. And a 34-inch, like, booty, basically.
Yeah.
So hips, she was known for her assets and her body, but at the end of the day, she was fighting for trans rights because she identified as a woman. If we could talk a bit about her.
She's still alive.
Yeah, she's still kicking it.
She is still alive, yeah. So, again, another Southern girl, because she was born in New Orleans.
It's a trend, yeah. Something going on.
Black Southern trans girls roll deep, honey. So she was born in the 40s. She actually was another woman who transitioned at a young age. and is actually documented as being supported by her mother. Mm. And so she, once she came of age, began singing and dancing in local nightclubs. So then she moved to L.A. in her 20s. And so, like you were saying, she was considered a staple in the nightclub circuit as a performer, as a female, at that time considered a female impersonator or illusionist. Mm-hmm. And so she was associated with people like Red Fox, Sammy Davis Jr., Richard Pryor, other folks who were like prominent at the time. And of course, right, she was marveled because, again, of kind of the, like, curiosity from cis mm-hmm. people of mm-hmm. someone being, you know, assigned male at birth and being considered beautiful or attractive as, you know, as a woman. And what, you know, and what that means, again, for the complexity of gender and sexuality. Mm-hmm. So, like, again, like you said, she... in 1967, so this is even before Stonewall, she started picketing outside of the club that Red Fox owned. And she, I don't know, she hired the ACLU, but she was working with the ACLU, and they basically helped her with her case, yeah. right? And so... So the courts rejected the case, basically saying that because she didn't own the club that she couldn't sue. And this was really because the LAPD, again, was shutting down performances, and particularly her performances. Mm-hmm. And so, again, criminalizing her for being a Black trans woman and for doing her job well.
Right.
So, yeah, and so Sir Lady Java was known by many, particularly in the entertainment industry. And so she was covered in magazines all the time, like Jet and Variety. She was in different performances with high-profile people, mm-hmm. like Lena Horne. She was in a movie. And so she's just been she was a pioneer. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she's documented as being, as keeping a lower public profile once the 80s hit. But she is still living in Southern California. There's a more recent interview from like 2006. If you Google Sir Lady Java, you can find it. And she kind of talks about her experiences. And she also in 2016, was honored at the Trans Pride in LA. Mm-hmm. And so people still know of her. She's still legendary and iconic. One of my dreams is to interview her, but I have not found a good contact for her because mm-hmm. I've never met her.
We got to track her down.
Yeah, I'm like, we got to make
find
this interview
her. Happen. Yeah, we're going to connect you guys.
Yeah, I would love to, like, you know, document her story.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
You know, because our elders deserve that mm-hmm. And deserve to know that they are still affecting people even after all these decades.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of just a quick tangent to, like, trans history now. Do you know of any efforts, or maybe even just explaining what the importance of efforts of, like, documenting Black trans history right now, and what are ways that people can go about it? I mean, obviously, like, we have internets, yeah. but we have the internet and phones and laptops and things like that.
I encourage all of us really to mm-hmm. listen more to our elders, even when we may not agree all the time, right? Mm-hmm. We know that, but they have so much insight to share, and I am constantly in awe of their longevity, the ones that we do still have with us. Mm-hmm. And when we think about Black trans legends, right, and all that they've endured from the criminal justice system in every mm-hmm. decade to the HIV AIDS epidemic of the 80s, which wiped out so many greats, mm-hmm. we really need to hold on to the people we do have. People like Miss Major, who's around still.
Yeah.
And opening, she's actually working on a new effort in Little Rock, Arkansas for the Southern trans girls there. Oh. People like Dee Dee Chambly, who is a personal mentor of mine from Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. People like Arlene Budd. She passed, I think she actually might have passed away. But there are all of these great people. Mm-hmm. And other legends who are a little bit younger, like Cecilia Chung, other people like that. So people like Ruby Corrado, people like Felicia Flames, these are trans heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them are still doing the work. I will also say that there are some books out there about some of our trans and gender nonconforming amazing people. Lady Chablis, who was an amazing performer from Savannah, she actually wrote a memoir called Hiding My Candy. You can guess that's about. and she was a major performer, somewhat like Sir Lady Java in the Southern Circuit, based in Savannah, Georgia. And she was actually in a high-grossing movie in the late 90s called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Hmm.
So she's amazing. She passed away a few years ago, maybe like 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Cheryl Courtney Evans, an amazing black trans woman from Atlanta, passed away a few years ago. And she actually she was keeping a blog when she was still alive. So you may want to look her up. Mm-hmm. And she had a Twitter too.
Did you mention that she was your mentor?
Yeah, Cheryl Courtney Evans was also a mentor too. And so I actually knew her very well in the Atlanta area when I was first getting into kind of the local trans activism there. And so she always was like, you know, a mother to the community. I did some videos with her getting her story down.
Mm-hmm.
This was, you know, before I was like even, you know, who I am today.
Mm-hmm.
But I see that as so important. To chronicle these people.
Mm-hmm.
And so her blog actually was called A Bitch for Justice.
Yes.
Love it.
So Google that. Andrea Jenkins. So she is the amazing black trans woman who became the first trans woman on a major of color on a major city's council mm-hmm. in Minneapolis back in November.
Mm-hmm.
She actually does a lot of work as a historian, and she has the Trans Oral History Project that should be coming out at some point soon. But she basically has interviewed almost 200 trans people about their stories. Mm. She interviewed me, and so I can't wait to see that full project come out. And they're just amazing people. There are people like Raina Gossett, mm-hmm. right, who is chronicling a lot of Marsha P. Johnson's history,
mm-hmm.
Who has her film about Marsha P. Johnson is coming out
mm-hmm.
this year. So there's a lot of work going on. I would say check out all of those people, all of those projects, and support us, right? Give us Definitely. Chances to tell the stories we need to tell for our community.
Mm-hmm.
There's no conversation that we can talk about trans history without talking about Marsha P. Johnson.
Marsha P. Johnson is essentially considered like the mother of mm-hmm. like trans movement, mm-hmm. right? One of the people who really put LGBTQ equality in general on the map, right? So all of these cis white people with all of this access sitting in their cozy corporate offices with their partners and their 2.5 children can thank people like Marsha P. Johnson and her partner in crime and amazing Latina Sylvia Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
So Marsha P. Johnson is basically Yeah, I mean, she's like that bitch. She's that bitch. And she was there during the Stonewall riots in 1969, mm-hmm. which is considered the pivotal moment for, at that time, queer, well, people weren't using queer, at that time, gay and lesbian folks, and more, people were really using drag queen more than something like trans, because mm-hmm. that wasn't around then. Mm-hmm. For all of those folks to start rising up and demanding equality. And so Stonewall was being raided by the police. People were being brutalized, right? So there's this long, again, history of criminalization of queer and trans people. Mm-hmm. And Marsha P. Johnson is documented by some as throwing a shot glass and saying, I got my civil rights, and essentially, like, starting this basically bash back onto the police, right? And so this went on for two nights. And this is seen as like a very pivotal moment. And so Marsha was a drag performer. She was a drag queen. She had a very complex relationship with her gender, right? So she definitely was gender nonconforming. Mm-hmm. Definitely consider herself a transvestite at points. Mm-hmm. And so she had a very complex identity. So sometimes people feel weird about saying that, you know, she is the OG, like, trans woman. Mm-hmm. But she definitely was a gender nonconforming trans person and identified as such throughout various points in her life. Mm-hmm. So her and Sylvia Rivera started Star House, which basically was their opportunity to give back to younger drag queens, trans women, and gay kids who were living on the streets, right? Because in that time, if you were queer, you were probably going to be kicked out of your home and living homeless without access to the things you needed. And so they created that house to take care of people near Christopher Street in New York City. And mm-hmm. so that Star House has really, it has been like an example that people have looked at as what, you know, what our journey towards liberation can look like. It can look like trans people caring for trans people. It can mm-hmm. look like some of the projects around housing that people are moving across the country, more so in like New York. Some folks are having conversations about land trusts and how trans people can own places to take care of our people. Mm-hmm. It also laid the foundation for, I would say, how trans people have taken care of each other when it comes to healthcare, right? So like, there's a lot of stigma around black market hormones, but when you don't have health insurance mm-hmm. Or you don't have access to health care, you really don't have that many options when it comes to living, you know, in your fullest authenticity. Mm-hmm. So all of these things really paved the way for a lot of people. And though Johnson and Rivera were honored at various points, they really lived most of their lives in poverty,
yeah,
and being forgotten. Mm-hmm. It's very tragic to hear, you know, after all of what Marsha did in activism, right? So even in the 80s, she was fighting with groups like ACT UP, yeah, who were doing these direct actions and all of this work around getting pressure onto the state for not taking care of all of the queer people who were dying from the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the 80s, mm-hmm. you know, because Ronald Reagan was ignoring,
yeah,
people's cries for help.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did work with them and still, unfortunately, lived a very much more difficult life than someone who we consider a legend should be.
Yeah.
And she was found face down in the Hudson River.
Yeah.
In 1992. Mm-hmm. And so she was, you know, many people think she was murdered, right? Mm-hmm. And think that there was foul play, but her case wasn't given consideration. And so it's really been the last, like, I would say within the last, like, 10 years or so that more and more trans people have been learning more and more about her story and also pushing efforts to get her the justice that she deserves.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw recently, right, with Raina Gossett chronicling the stories of Marsha P. Johnson. She actually uncovered a lot of what we know about Marsha through tireless work in libraries and going through archives and stuff like that. And so when she called out the director, David Franz, of the life and the death and life of Marsha P. Johnson, which was released on Netflix, got this huge multi-million-dollar Netflix deal. She was well within her right.
Yeah.
Because this is a white cis gay man who essentially
profited off her labor.
Yeah. Material from her work, lifted energy from her labor, created this documentary, and basically overshadowed the work that Raina had long been working on. And so it's been great in some ways to see how people, you know, because when you're a black woman, period, trying to, like, speak up against someone with power and privilege and access, you're likely to get shot down. You're likely to get the Monique treatment. But people have embraced Raina, and so I'm excited for the release, the official release of her film, Happy Birthday, Marsha, and some of the other work that she's working on. I think we have to elevate the work of our people, because who else is doing it?
Definitely.
Well, we're going to wrap up that conversation, this conversation with you, but thank you so much for
everything.
Yeah, the labor that you have done, like reading into these stories and things like that, despite the fact that you're not a historian.
You say you're not an historian, but
I love it, right? This is me getting on my soapbox again, but spend most of your life, like, not seeing yourself anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like you should want to try and create a world where you, where no one else has to live that anymore, right? And so, you know, that is why trans women of color, black trans women are so integral to my work and integral to the vision I want to see in the world. We've just got to continue to find ways to uncover it so everyone else can be in tune to what we already know is that black trans women must be trusted with the keys to the future.
Yeah. For a president. And, like, everyone in the House, everyone in the Senate. If you want.
Right.
Because, like,
no, I want.
This
I
country
want.
Is shit, so, like.
Thank you so much.
It's an uphill battle right now.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Raquel. Can you give us some information to our listeners if they want to follow you, let's say, on Twitter or Instagram or anything like that?
I don't know what these things you're talking about are. I try to play silly, like I don't know what social media is.
It's like we were talking about this Twitter thread the whole episode, though, so your bluff has been called.
Right. That's so true. So I'm Raquel Willis, writer, activist, national organizer at Transgender Law Center. You can find my website at raquelwillis.com, RAQUELWILLIS.com. You can find me on Twitter as Raquel Willis _. You can find me on Facebook, I got a little page on there, so you know. Instagram, Raquel _ Willis. But essentially, I'm the same on all platforms. And if you want to check out the dope, amazing work that my colleagues and I engage on the daily, check out transgenderlawcenter.org.
Awesome, awesome. All of which will be in the description for this episode, along with the numerous people that you shouted out, both past and present. Go in the description for this episode to find out more.
Thank you all for everything you're doing. I need to go back and listen to more episodes.
Thank you. Thank
you. They're waiting for you.
Yeah, whenever you're ready. Okay, have a good evening.
Thank you.
Damn, that was a dope-ass interview.
It was really good.
Yeah.
I always, like I say, I always learn something, and I hope you guys learn something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine if they didn't.
But if you'd like to follow us on social media, you could do so at Inner Hoe Uprising without the G, on Twitter, Inner Hoe Uprising, on Instagram and Facebook with the G, innerhoeuprising.com to pay a bitch, to pay a hoe, or check out merchandise.
Yeah, we don't go by bitch anymore. We go by hoe.
We go by hoes.
We're real elevated ladies, if you know what I mean.
And if you would like to follow me, because Sam never fucking goes first.
I don't even follow you.
If you well, that's true. If other people would like to follow me other than Sam.
They don't even follow you. Sorry.
You can follow me at Revy or Not on Instagram and Twitter, and on Tumblr, No Need to Make Believe.
Cool. You can follow me at SlamRid on Instagram and Twitter, because we don't use Snapchat no more, except for when you're following Mistress Unknown.
Because it's amazing.
Yes.
But yeah, thanks, guys. Bye. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.